Now, real people, real opinions. Nighttime Talk with Niall Boylan.
Ireland's classic hits radio.
It's that time of the night. So, I've explained this before at this time of the night. Jane never tells me who the guest is until about 20 minutes beforehand. She hands me a piece of paper. And she thinks that's exciting. Because I'm in the dark as much as everybody else. And I think it's exciting as well, because then I'm just as surprised to hear the story. And tonight, we've got a good one for you. If you've seen the Netflix documentary called The Psychopath Life Coach, have you seen that? Anyone seen the Netflix documentary? It's called The Psychopath Life Coach. I've seen the trailer for it. I can't remember actually watching it, but there you go. The Psychopath Life Coach. You will know who Lewis Raymond Taylor is. And he is The Psychopath Life Coach. And he joins us now to discuss his incredible life and incredible work. Lewis, hi, how are you?
Hello, thanks for the introduction. I'm great, thanks, how are you?
And by the way, I watched the trailer for the show and I've read up a few bits and pieces of it. Well done, by the way, for taking your life from one extreme to the other, and now you're a very successful businessman and wealthy multimillionaire. So well done, congratulations.
Thank you. Well, I'm very pleased to be given a nice, warm welcoming based off the trailer, because the trailer in itself is quite sensationalized and, you know, designed to capture people's attention. And it doesn't really do it.
Well, Netflix do that. Netflix do that expertly, I have to be honest with you. But despite, exactly. Yeah, I mean, if we can go back in time as well, you know, despite suffering sexual abuse, mental illness, addiction, mm-hmm. bereavement, a lot of financial debt, a suicide attempt, and even spending multiple times in prison, which you did, we'll come to that again in a few minutes as well, you managed to get yourself into a situation now where you transformed your life, and you're now being featured in Forbes as an entrepreneur and a TEDx speaker as well, and owning your own 25 million coaching empire. Go back to the start, if you can. When did the bad stuff start for you?
Yeah. Well, I'll try and do a summary of it, because obviously we don't have so long to discuss it, and it is a long one, which is why the documentary is an hour and a half, and even that sort of, you know, the highlights or the low lights, I guess you could say. But, yeah, I grew up in a bit of a dysfunctional family where my dad was an alcoholic, and he would put me down a lot, and he'd, you know, call me names. He'd also hit me, and my mum was very emotionally disconnected. She came from a background where, you know, you don't cuddle or tell each other you love you. So I didn't really get that emotional support.
And she didn't question your father's authority, obviously, because that was the way it was, I suppose.
Yeah, it was just the way it was. Yeah, I don't think we knew much different. I think back then, you know, corporal punishment, giving your child a few hits was normal. So that was the environment I grew up in. And I was just a bad kid, you know, it's just how it started, bad behavior. And, you know, I'd light fires, I'd you know, smash windows. I would, you know, do those sorts of bits and pieces, light fires. But really what I was doing was trying to get attention. And I was trying to get attention from my dad, really, because in hindsight, I just wanted to be loved by my dad. But you don't know that when you're a kid and you're just reacting to things. And I also found that I wanted to do some acting, singing and dancing. That was something that I thought I could get some attention in. And I started doing that. And then I was sexually abused there. So that really sort of put things up, you know, went off the rails even more. Mm-hmm. That was when I was going into secondary school.
So you were 12 or 13 years of age at that stage.
Yeah. And at that time I just, you know, started doing smoking cannabis and started getting in trouble with the school. I eventually got expelled at an ASBO. I don't know if you have that over in Ireland, but in the UK it's
an we know what that is. Yeah.
You know what that's for. Yeah.
JLOs, they call them, yeah.
JLOs, right, okay. So they have one of those. And then, yeah, things just progressed. And I was, you know, getting this reinforced message over and over again that I was bad because I was doing bad things and I was getting labelled as bad. And I was bad, you know. And because of that, it felt like this identity and this character. And that was the person I was, and that was that. And things would just get worse and worse. And the progression of drink and drugs would just make me more mentally unstable. Would make me act out more aggressively. I started to fight. And that's when I started to go to get sent to prison. And I went to a young offenders institution when I was just 18.
Wow. What was that like, by the way? Were you scared? Oh, yeah, were you a tough guy?
To be honest,
guy?
I had this really warped... No, it wasn't that I was a tough guy necessarily at the time, and that was when I was just starting to fight, really. I felt quite paralysed my whole life from my dad hitting me and not feeling like I could hit him back, and it was only when sort of later on in life that I realised I could fight back and sort of became that tough guy, if you like. But there was always this sort of strange, warped perspective over who I was and what I needed to do to be somebody. And prison at that time, strangely, felt as though I was doing something with my life. So there was a strange, warped sense of excitement and pride that came with that, if I'm being totally honest.
Yeah, this is what I was meant to be. This is what I'm meant to do, yeah.
Yeah, this is me. This is people like me. This is where we go. And my friends are going to be, you know, thinking this is, you know, I don't know, giving me points for this. So it was difficult in there. I mean, Young Offenders Institution is not a place you want to be. You know, everyone wants to get more time added to their sentence, you know, to brag about it. And people want to, you know, prove themselves. And yeah, there are a lot of fights in there, and it is a rough place to be. But
what did your dad think of you? I mean, did they kind of disown you at that point in your life when you were in the Offenders?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, yeah, they used the saying ring fenced, which I'd never actually heard of before, but ring fence essentially makes a fence around me to stop me from affecting, because I was selling drugs at this point, and I was also getting my brother to sell drugs for me, and he was younger than me. So I was having my 15-year-old brother selling drugs for me. So I was affecting my family, and they just essentially cut me off, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then throughout the time of sort of my more drug addicted years, my dad ended up getting cancer, and I walked in, found him dead, to add to the list of traumas.
How did you feel about that? This man that treated you so badly, when you walked in and found him dead, was there an element of relief to it, as well as bereavement?
Not immediately. I think later on, I really do think I was able to grow. Going to sound really ruthless, but I really was able to grow with him kind of out of the picture, because he was this big weight. You know, he used to call me stupid and a buffoon and tell me I never amount to anything, and I believed him, and I was scared either way. I was scared I was either going to prove him right, or I was scared that I was going to prove him wrong.
You were on the losing team, whichever you did, really, weren't you?
Exactly. So later on, I can look back and sort of be like, I was able to grow when I had this sort of runway and this, you know, without that.
I mean, here's a stupid question, Lewis. Did you love him?
I did love him, yeah. Yeah, I did love him, but love is a strange thing, especially, you know, with the title Psychopath Life Coach, which we should probably explain. So when I was 18, I felt like I got some significance and some attention through fighting, you know, so I started to fight more. And I started to win some fights, and I started to feel strong, and I started to get recognition from people, and, you know, and it kind of filled that void inside, which is, I think a lot of people could probably relate to that, probably never admit to that. But there's a reason why people go out and fight. It's not because they want to get blood in their hands. It's because it gives them some sort of
power,
fills some kind of need.
Yeah.
Yeah, power, exactly. And I was taking my power back, and I was doing that, and it got to a point where I was committing some serious crimes. I don't know if you have the same, if you have GBH over there.
Grievous bodily harm,
So I had a few of those, but luckily I didn't get sent to prison. I was kind of on remand, on trial. I always looked well presented. I could put a suit on and look pretty, I could slip under the radar. So I was able to stand on, not go to prison and wait for my sentence. And during that time, they sent me for a pre-sentence report. And it was where probation kind of analyzed your home life and you, and kind of make a recommendation to the court as to how long you're going to get in prison or what sort of order you should get. And the lady sent me for a psychiatric assessment, and I just thought it was part of the process, but it turned out it wasn't. It was because she just noticed that I didn't show any empathy or remorse or significance of what I'd done. And she was like, Lewis, because at one point she said, Lewis, you're looking at 8 years in prison for these crimes. I said, I don't care.
Yeah.
And she said, I'm also recommending you for an IPP, which is an indefinite public protection order, which is a life sentence. You won't be released from prison until you're deemed safe to be released. the same one Charles Bronson's got, who's been in there for over 40 years.
Yeah.
I'm glad I didn't get that. Wow. It's been since abolished. But I, it just went straight over my head. And I she sent me for the psychiatric assessment, and the psychiatrist diagnosed me with an antisocial personality disorder. And I Googled it, and it came up with a psychopath. So a psychopath isn't actually a clinically diagnosed term, but it's more of a label that's given to people that have these antisocial personality
disorders.
Yeah,
there's a massive stigma to the label, isn't there? I mean, when you hear the word psychopath, you start thinking about serial killers.
Exactly. But you'd actually find that I've actually recently done some studying on it, and 33% of CEOs are psychopaths.
Right.
Staggering amount.
Yeah, well, I suppose, when you look at people when you look at people like Steve Jobs, and we all know the story of Steve mm-hmm. Jobs, he was probably a psychopath. I mean, he was so...
I've read his book. The book that was written about him, and he disowned his daughter from birth.
That's right,
she will not help me with my mission. And
he wouldn't even pay maintenance for his own daughter. That's right. He would, and not only that, he treated his employees like dirt, you know?
Mm-hmm.
People who got him to where he was. So you are right. A lot of CEOs, and they do say that to be successful, sometimes in business, you got to be mean to people. Now, I don't always agree that that's the case, but I'm sure there are some good employers. No.
I think you have to be assertive. You have to make decisions. I mean, it might not always be favorable for certain people, but if it's for the greater good, then someone's got to make them.
Yeah, but isn't it hard? It's hard, I suppose.
To take it being mean.
Yeah, it's hard to sit in an office and tell someone they're fired, you know, if they're a nice person. Mm. You got to be a certain type of person to do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Elon Musk recently, would he let go of, I think, 40,000 Twitter employees, didn't they, or something?
Yeah, well, he didn't have to do it. That's the difference. He just makes the decision. He doesn't have to sit in the office and say, listen, you're on your last legs there, goodbye. But, what age were you now at this stage when you got that diagnosis?
18.
Okay.
But I didn't think anything of it. You know, I just thought, you know, because I just thought, you know, this is some... could be Two Shoes who's looking at my life and looking at it and thinking, this guy must be crazy. And I didn't actually think I had anything wrong with me, or, you know, I did that in quote marks, but I didn't have any disorders. Love is an interesting thing, and a lot of emotions are quite interesting to me because they definitely feel different to a lot of other people's. I would say they are shallower than most people's, and I don't know whether that's... it could come from a number of places. It's that whole nature and nurture conversation, isn't it? It could have come from birth. It could have come from trauma. It could have come from not being emotionally nurtured as a young child and not learning to express those feelings properly. Or it could come from this disorder that I developed or had from birth or whatever, or a combination of them all. I don't really know, but I do sometimes observe myself compared to other people, and I do notice a difference.
Mm.
And emotions for me are definitely on the lower.
Do you get social cues, for example? I mean, they often say that psychopaths don't see social cues, so they don't understand empathy, or they don't understand when they're hurting somebody's feelings, or they don't get those social cues. Do you get those?
I don't think that's, as I understand it, that's not necessarily so much the case. I think they do get it. They just
ignore
it. Feel it. They see it. They can understand it. They can intellectualize it. So, for example, for me, I can understand someone's pain more than I can feel their pain.
Yeah.
I can get
it. Yeah, no, that just makes sense.
And I also need to receive love in a way that is visible. You know, I will make a calculation as to whether somebody loves me or not, rather than feeling a warm, fuzzy feeling so much.
Yeah. Okay. So, by the way, are you in a relationship now?
Yeah, I'm married.
Okay.
Baby.
So are you into public displays of affection?
I am, of course. Yeah. And I do.
Yeah, I'm like
love,
that too.
I just don't know if.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's as much as some people. Because it's a spectrum. And you've got empaths, which are people that are so consumed by emotions to the point where they watch a film and they cry, or they hear someone's story and they're absorbed by it and they can't get it off their mind for 2 weeks. You know, you've got that person. And then you've got the psychopath that could, you know, kill somebody and then go to sleep.
Yeah.
And then you've got a whole range of people in the middle. I believe I am on that spectrum somewhere. Whether or not that, you know, deems me a psychopath or not, whether or not that deems me an antisocial personality disorder or not. There's even people that since the doctor mentioned have messaged me and said they think I'm autistic. But these are all labels. You know, we're all very individual in the way we are, and it could be a combination of things. But I did definitely notice some differences. But yeah, I love. I can feel love. I can feel emotions. They just have to be significant. They have to be obvious. I remember when I first met my wife, I said, "Look, if you're going to love me, you need to really show it to me, because I'm not going to believe you. I'm not going to."
But that's it. I was reading about this recently, and that's a male thing, by the way, as well as anything else. Like, for example,
okay,
you know, women, you know, show love differently to men, or women feel loved mm-hmm. differently to men. When a woman wants or has sex with a man, he feels loved. It's physical. But a woman mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily have to have sex to feel loved. Whereas men show their emotion by having sex or by giving a hug or by. So men are different to women in that respect anyway. But you are obviously on the extreme end of that as well, where you have to feel or see the physical love.
Yeah, and sex is one of them, actually, because it was one of the closest sort of sensations of a feeling that I could get. So I would chase those intense feelings, which is why I used to gamble or take drugs or fight. And, you know, it's because it would stimulate me. And it's now why I'm into business. And it's, and, you know, I'm satisfying those kind of stimulatory urges to in an attempt to feel as much as I possibly can, because it can feel quite flat.
I mean, during that tough time as well, obviously, you had a suicide attempt. What happened at that point that you felt that there was no way out?
So I was 18, and it's when I started to drink, and I'd got into my first relationship. And I tell you what, I've had a load of traumas in my life, but heartbreak's definitely up there.
Oh, yeah.
Because, especially your first, because you don't quite understand it. You feel like your world's over. And when I sort of found this girl, at the time I thought to myself, you know what, maybe I'm not quite as bad as I thought, maybe I am lovable, maybe I'm not this stupid, you know, person that dad's making me out, and she's kind of seeing this different side of me that no one's seen before. And then one night, a year into our relationship, she told me she cheated on me, and I literally saw red and blacked out. Maybe this is some of the psycho in me, but
yeah.
The next thing I know, I'd smashed her kitchen up. I pulled a drawer out, and I dropped the drawer on the floor. And I didn't even mean to do it, but my hand picked up and just sliced both sides of my neck, and I clipped an artery
in
my neck.
God.
And essentially slit my own throat. And I was sectioned under the Mental Health Act. So this is another, obviously, a reason as to why these mental health conditions start to stack up in terms of their plausibility. But yeah, I was, interestingly enough, just released the next day there, and it was sort of chalked up to just sort of a drunken teenage
rampage
argument or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And throughout the years, I was also diagnosed with bipolar and also emotionally unstable personality disorder. I was given antipsychotic medication. Yeah, things
and are you controlling? Can you control all of that now? I mean, what's the likelihood of... And I hope your wife never cheats on you. But what's it like if your marriage ever broke down, or you didn't get the love you expect, or whatever it is, you know, or you didn't get the success that you expect? I imagine success goes hand in hand with all of that as well. Or something goes wrong. Mm. What's the likelihood of you resorting back to that 18-year-old again?
It's very unlikely, because I've got so much awareness. Back then, I was acting on autopilot. I definitely don't have bipolar or the emotionally unstable personality disorder. Mm. I think that was misdiagnosis, and it was just, you know, one session with a psychiatrist and then chucking a label on me. And I think the closest one is the antisocial personality disorder, because I do notice that one. Even now I've developed my life, even now I've got clean and sober, even though it's been 8 years since I've been, you know, came out of prison. And
yeah.
I still notice some of those traits and some of those attributes to that disorder. But I've got so much awareness now, and I've uncovered and resolved so many of my traumas, and don't feel like that bad, unlovable, traumatized kid anymore. So I wouldn't need to react.
And you know
what? And I'd be able to
bring in children into your world as well. That makes a huge difference, doesn't it?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got to be a role model now. And I want to break that pattern. You know, I know that my dad didn't have a great relationship with his dad. He told me he hated his dad. So
yeah.
I know that this is probably some generational trauma that's happening here. So
yeah.
The generational trauma ends here with me.
So when did your luck turn around? Because I want to get to the point now where you're now featured in Forbes as an entrepreneur. You're a TEDx speaker, and you're worth 25 million. Yeah. So how do you go from being an 18-year-old renegade and lunatic, essentially, to being a multimillionaire with a successful business? What was that point? When was that day?
Well, I was 24 years old and I had my last fight. I was outside a taxi queue and some guy shouted in my face. It reminded me, it's no excuse, but it reminded me of my dad to the point that I don't even remember what the guy looked like because all I can see is my dad right now pointing in my face. That's how much he triggered me. But no excuse whatsoever. Didn't deserve what I did, but I punched him and he hit his head on the ground and he had a brain hemorrhage and I got sentenced to prison for GBH again. And I rang up my friend when I went to prison and I said, what are people saying about me? And he said, you're on the front page of the paper. I said, okay, I don't care about that. What else are people saying? He said, well, your friend has posted a picture on social media. One picture is you outside court the day you were sentenced, and one picture was you outside the exact same courtroom 7 years before, but with the caption above it, nothing changes. Mm. And that was actually the moment where I realized that nothing had changed in those 7 years. I was doing the same things over and over again, expecting a different result. And if you've heard of that saying,
yeah,
I'm not going to quote it as my own because I think it's an Einstein quote, but, yeah, it's the definition of insanity is doing the same things over and over again and expecting a different result. And I was doing the same things over and over again and expecting a different result. I didn't want that for my life, but I kept on ending up back there. And I realized that nothing had changed. So as cliche as this might sound, well, I always think it sounds cliche, but this is maybe not normal for other people's lives. But I went back to my prison cell and I looked in the mirror and I really had a good look at myself. And I just made a decision to change my life. Myself, because I'd never really took responsibility. I'd never really realized that I was the person that needed to change. I blamed everything and everyone around me for why my life was so difficult. And in all honesty, I didn't think change was possible. But when he said nothing changes, I kind of thought, oh, wow, yeah, nothing has changed. And I'm the problem. But in realizing I was the problem, I kind of thought that I could also be the solution. And this sounds a bit cheesy, but it's genuinely the truth. And I latched on because I've got this obsessive compulsive personality as well. With the addict in me.
Yeah.
I've been addicted to everything you can imagine to the extreme, you know?
Yeah.
And I just become quite addicted to changing myself. And I just accessed all the services that are available. I didn't think there were any. I was one of those people that like, no one wants to help me. Everyone's out to get me.
Yeah. It's everybody else's fault, not mine.
But then immediately I started seeing counseling and a rehab program and a gym and a library and maths and English lessons all inside prison. And I just started trying them out. And I did the rehab, 6-week rehab program inside there. And that taught me so much. I thought, wow, this stuff actually works. Because I could notice changes in myself. And like I said, I didn't think anyone was going to, I could change. I thought if there was anyone that was going to change, it wasn't going to be me. Even my mum said, we all know that Lewis is not going to make old bones. We know he's going to, you know, die young essentially because he's the way he is. But I'd noticed some changes and I sort of got latched onto it and I just wanted more. So I carried on, did some maths and English in prison. That was the first bit of education I'd done since I was expelled from school at 15 and passed the tests and set myself a goal to go to university. And then during one of the 6-week rehab program, someone came in and did this guest speaking talk about going and doing a more extensive rehab program. And it was a 6-month program and I had to do it after my release. And I thought to myself, right, I could go back to my old town, hope that I'm changed enough to be able to develop my life, or I can go and do this rehab program down by the coast, down by the sea, completely different life. I live sort of close to the city. And really, really make some changes and, you know, make sure I don't slip back into addiction and all that sort of stuff. So I did, and I applied for that and I got accepted. It was a £20,000 rehab program.
Yeah.
And they picked me up from the gates of prison down to the rehab and I thought it was going to be like a retreat, you know, a lovely yoga, mindfulness, meditation or something.
Yeah.
It was absolute torture. I'll tell you what, I'd have preferred to be in prison. They just broke me down and built me back up. It was 24-hour therapy because I thought they was going to teach me to not drink and not take drugs, but actually they didn't mention that almost once. It was about me and why I felt the need to use those external substances to fix the internal problems, you know. And I walked out there and I had my head clear. For the first time in my life, I started volunteering. I signed on for benefits, you know, like the dole. I don't know if you call it the dole.
Yeah.
But support allowance. And then I started going to AA meetings and Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And I just started to help people. And I started to help people for free as well. So I would see people online that looked a little bit depressed. And I'd say, hey, do you want to come meet me for a coffee? And then I would just help them. And I realized that I'd learned so much from changing my own life and getting clean, and also from other people's experiences as well, because sitting in rehab, sitting in AA meetings and learning people's relapses and denials and triggers and traumas and setbacks and limiting beliefs and stories in their head, you learn a lot. And I was helping people and I realized that I was really good at it.
And you could make money out of it.
Yeah, well, that wasn't my first thought.
I know. You wanted to make other people feel the way you felt, and you wanted to help other people to change their lives and do what you did and show them how easy, well, not how easy it was, because it certainly wasn't easy, but how that it was possible. Yeah. So you wanted to do that, and I suppose turning that into a business then was the next step.
Well, this is like 8 years ago as well, and I mean, I started, because I thought, I could be a life coach, actually, and did some online research. First of all, I called myself a personal development mentor. This is before the big sort of coaching boom. And if indeed you know about the boom, I might be so immersed in it. I feel like it's boomed, and you might not even know that. But there's a lot more coaches now than there were before.
Yeah.
I think the coaching masters actually had a big impact on that.
I've talked to so many life coaches. Now, none of them as interesting as you, by the way. But I've talked to so many life coaches on the air, and some of them, they're really good. They have interesting information, but some of them are just people who've had experiences in life. You know, but yours is it's an extraordinary story. It really is. I don't mean to minimize by calling it a story, because it's your life. It's not just a story.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm looking on your website. It says, my mission is to bring awareness to coaching so people can raise their children in a safe and nurturing way, which I completely agree with, by the way. I can achieve this by sharing my story, delivering training that has taken thousands of people and coaching elite coaches to achieve exponential growth and in their business, so they can spread the power of coaching across the globe with me. And underneath that it says, business valuation 25 million, paying customers 8,000, country served 85. Well done.
Thanks very much. Yeah, because this was before the pandemic, this was before online business, and my first sort of trial at life coaching was going to a networking meeting and drinking a cup of coffee with four people in a room and giving out a business card. And I thought, this is not going to work. And what I didn't realize is, because of all these years of thinking I was stupid, I never even tried to use my brain. So I realized I had a knack for business. I just randomly stumbled upon it, really, and just had this intuitive understanding of how social media and the online world worked. And I just thought, why is everyone trying to get clients in the real world when you can just access millions of them online?
Yeah.
So I started doing some simple marketing strategies, like sharing my story and reaching out to people and, you know, creating a website and things like that. And
podcasts.
Started getting clients that way and delivering the sessions online. So doing I was doing Facebook video calls and Skype calls way before Zoom even existed, you know, doing my sessions and getting clients from Australia and America and things like that. And, you know, it was revolutionary at the time. And then I started to scale up and create digital products and courses and membership sites and using the technology to be able to share the value that I had with more people and make obviously more money in the process.
Mm-hmm.
But the real honest truth of it is just the product was amazing. You know, our courses that we deliver are life-changing. And, you know, that's the key to any business. Of course, you've got to have savvy marketing technology skills and be a visionary and all those things. But it all comes down to, if you've got something good to sell and people want to buy it, they will. So, you know, our course, because now what we do, our core business now is evolved so high. In a sense where we don't even necessarily do the coaching anymore. We actually train life coaches. So we will provide people with the qualifications and the accreditations they need to become a life coach, and then help them build the business, and then help them go out and help
other people,
you know, thousands of people throughout their career. So we have a bigger ripple effect that way.
So you're now at the top of that triangle.
Exactly. Yeah. We don't monetize any of the other things underneath. By the way, it's not like a network marketing. It's not like we take a percentage or anything like that. We're simply education. So
yeah,
people do our education. They learn how to get the clients, and then some people travel the world and they go and live in Bali. And that's no exaggeration, by the way. We even built our own coaching cafe in Bali because there were so many coaches out there.
Okay.
Yeah, we got a whole coaching cafe out there.
I can see all the courses here. You know, there's a 12-week intermediary course. There's a 24-week advanced course, a 20-week advanced course, mm-hmm. different types of courses that are all available. And I also see on your website as well, there's a podcast section as well. Is that you interviewing people or is that just other podcasters? Yeah, yeah. So that's you interviewing people.
Oh, no, they are. So it depends if you're looking at my website or because you've got my website, which is...
This is your website, yeah.
And that's me. But then you've got the coachingmasters.com, which is the business, which has its own trainers, its own whole team. You know, we have a team of about 50 or 60 people now who sort of run that, a lot of the business operations and the training.
And what does it feel like now? You know, you're talking to me now on the radio, you know, and when you were 18, you were a head case, okay? Now you're talking to me on the radio and you're a successful businessman who's been recognized by Forbes as a featured entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. You're a TEDx speaker and you're worth 25 million quid. What is that? Does that feel surreal to you now?
It does feel surreal, but it's so strange. It's kind of in limbo because, part of me feels like I'm just telling someone else's story because I'm so detached from it because it's so far away. But another part of me feels like I'm just getting started as well because I'm the new part of me, this new Lewis, or maybe the Lewis that was there all along that I'd never had a chance to sort of give any life to, has only recently been born over the last 8 years, if that makes sense.
Yeah, what do you think your dad would say if he was around now?
Yeah, I've been asked this question before, and I would love to say he would think he was, I'm sure he would have no other thing. He couldn't not be proud, could he? I mean, he hasn't really got any
jealous, maybe, I don't
grounds
know.
To not be. But part of me does kind of feel like he would have something to say because he always seemed to find something.
I remember my dad.
I remember I got a job once.
Yeah, sorry. Go. You know, my dad said to me when I wanted to work in a record shop at 17 because I just liked music at the time. Mm-hmm. And my dad used to always keep saying, he used to sort of organize interviews for me in Aer Lingus in the airport because that's what he did, a 9-to-5 job. Yeah. And he said, you're never going to make money being a DJ. That's all he kept saying to me. I ended up being one of the biggest nightclub DJs in the country. I then moved to radio. I then moved to radio, and I have nine international awards now. So I think he was wrong. So from that point of view,
he was wrong.
Yeah, but I think he was very proud of him in the end. He died about 7 years ago, but I think he was very proud of him in the end. But I think your dad would be proud of you, but maybe a little bit jealous.
Yeah, I'm sure he would. Yeah, and the fact that he's calling me stupid and stuff like that, I mean.
Clearly
I wonder
not.
Where that come from and why he felt the need to do that. Yeah, clearly not. Yeah,
clearly not. And I have to say, the website looks great, by the way, as well. If people want to go to it, it's lewisraymondtaylor.com. And that's the website I'm looking at the moment. It's a fabulous looking website. It's a credit to you. Your business is a credit to you. Your story is a credit to you. Coming from what you were to what you are now is a credit for me. And then now I have to watch the Netflix documentary.
You do. Because you've only heard a fraction of it, to be honest. And there's some controversial twists along the way as well to make it interesting.
Yeah, we don't want to give the whole game away. By the way, before we finish up, what's next for Lewis Raymond Taylor?
I'm glad you said that because I'm already sort of, you know, knee deep into new things. So we're creating a new education platform that's outside of the coaching arena that's going to be for families to help both adults and children, because I think there's a real space to help co-learning platform and co-facilitate personal development and growth.
Yeah.
Because I don't think the education system is fit for the modern world.
Yeah, there are so many parents now that want to educate their children at home, and you know, homeschooling is becoming more popular now than it ever was, particularly after COVID. Homeschooling, and a lot of people are not happy with some of the stuff they're teaching in school, and that's their business or whatever they feel. So they want to educate at home. And I suppose anything that would help them do that would be good.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, there's no point teaching the children if it's not being enforced at home. And there's no point teaching the adults if they're not able to communicate it effectively to the children. So it makes sense to have this, you know, co-facilitated platform where adults and children can learn together within a family household, and also, you know, gamify that with incentives and points and tokens. So you might be able to say, you know, if we achieved, you know, 15 points by the end of the week, we might get pizza on Friday or whatever that might look like for the budget of the family.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm working towards. I'm also working towards doctorate. So I want to get, you know, really throw myself into education to be able to have a really plausible argument for an alternative solution. You know, I don't want to be misinformed and, you know, be able to create a different syllabus with not going through the traditional academic structure that's laid out at the moment. So I'm going on a big learning journey and a big development and diversification of the business, and also going to become a dad and see what other fun.
Congratulations.
Become a dad. I'm a dad, and sort of let that unfold. And
yeah, another one maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
There are a few. But look, I'm assuming, like every businessman, you want to be the next Elon Musk. I don't know. I don't know if I'd want to be worth $240 billion. I don't know. It'd be nice. Yeah. But in saying that, you're already successful, extremely successful. Well done to you. Congratulations and continued success in your career. It's an extraordinary story, and I'm glad all that's behind you. And I know, I don't know, it's difficult to tell that story over and again because obviously it brings back some bad memories too. So it can be a little bit difficult too. But I wish you all the success in the future. And if people want to go to your website, by the way, it's lewisraymondtaylor.com. That's lewisraymondtaylor.com. Or just Google him. Or watch the Netflix documentary. It's on Netflix. And the documentary is called The Psychopath Life Coach. That's him. Listen, thank you very much indeed. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us, Lewis.
Thank you very much. Just people can also check me out on Instagram as well, at lewisraymondtaylor. And I do respond to messages if anyone needs any help. And just one last thing I would say is, if anything's happened to you in your life and you're feeling like things have happened to you and all these things are stopping you from becoming the person that you want to be, just know that sometimes you can flip and reframe that until, you know, these things are happening for you and they're teaching you things to strengthen you as a person, and it doesn't have to hold you back and it doesn't need to be your identity. You can draw a line in the sand at any moment and become a different person. And, you know, I can speak that from experience. So anyway, thank you very much.
No, I get it. I get it. The bad things don't define you, that's for sure.
Now, real people, real opinions. Nighttime Talk with Niall Boylan.
Ireland's classic hits radio.